Good morning. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tuesday, February 13th, 2007 at approximately 1:30 in the afternoon. We're at the State Capitol Building in room 468 here in Pierce, South Dakota. This is the approximate time and place for the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission meeting. Before we jump into our agenda, I think it would be good to do a quick check on the phone. First off, is our Gene Callaghan and Marv Sorensen from Mid-American on the line? Can you hear us all right?
Yes.
Okay. We're quiet in here. Next, James Groff from Northern Valley.
Yep.
Great. Talbot Wazorek, representing Sprint.
I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Mary Sissick, Swiftel.
I'm here.
Great. Meredith Moore, ITC.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
James Overcash, also representing ITC.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Wendy Harper, Vantage Point.
I am here, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Clean Seabold, Quest.
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Jason Topp with Quest.
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Dave Ross with Otter Tail.
Yes, sir.
Good morning. Good afternoon. John Chow, Excel. Mr. Chow? Okay. Anybody else on the phone line that we neglected to call? But also note we have a pack.
Phil Zanzan
is joining the meeting.
Hi, this is Dusty Johnson with the PUC. Who just joined?
This is Phil Zins and John Chow from XL in Minneapolis.
Outstanding. Great. Thanks very much.
Yep.
We also have a full gallery here in Pierce, so, and a rather lengthy agenda. Before we do start, though, I wanted to mention two personnel issues. First off, we do have our new consumer affairs representative, Vicki Burns, with us today. So welcome aboard, Vicki. Thanks for joining the commission. And, you know, Vicki might be at the beginning of her state tenure, but we actually have someone who is celebrating 15 years with state government, and that is Leah Moore, and I think everybody with the commission would agree that Leah is a phenomenal coworker. She's got incredible skills and talents. Her work ethic and her professionalism are certainly unquestioned, and the commission is a better place because of Leah, and because this is her 15th anniversary with the state, not with the commission, but with the state, we have a lovely, very expensive and decorative pin that is to be worn at all times while on duty with the state, as well as an envelope that I can only presume has round-the-world airplane tickets or perhaps a cruise. Ms. Van Bakken can tell you more about that. And with that, we will proceed with our, we'll call the meeting to order and proceed with our agenda. Item number one under Consumer Reports is a status report on the consumer utility inquiries and complaints received by the Commission. Ms. Gregg.
Thank you. The Commission has received a total of 73 contacts since the last report was prepared for the January 23rd, 2007 Commission meeting. 9 of the contacts involved telecommunication services, 10 of the contacts involved electrical services, 14 contacts involved natural gas service, 5 contacts involved cellular phone, 29 related to the Do Not Call registry, and 6 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 99 of the 264 complaints received in 2007 have been resolved, and 2,161 of the 2,466 complaints received in 2006 have been resolved.
Thanks very much. Are there any questions from Ms. Gregg? Hearing none, we'll proceed to the electric portion of our agenda. Item number one is EL07-001. It's in the matter of the filing by Xcel Energy for approval of its revised rate sheets for its occasional delivery energy service and time of delivery energy service. The question is today, shall the Commission approve the revised tariff sheets? I see Mr. Wilcox at the microphone here in Pierre. Good afternoon, Mr. Wilcox.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, my name is Jim Wilcox. I work for Xcel Energy in South Dakota. On the phone today are John Chow and Phil Zins to help answer any questions we might have. The company is here requesting approval, and I think we're going to defer to Mr. Jacobson for most of this, so I just respectfully request approval, and we'll stand by for questions.
Great. Thanks very much, Mr. Wilcox. We will hold questions until we've heard from staff. Mr. Jacobson?
Thank you, Commissioner. The format and the inputs in this filing follow previous filings in this matter. In the previous filings, we were able to tie out the computations with Excel's PURPA 210 biennial report, which they file. but this filing reflects updated information from the last time they filed their PURPA filing. So it was not, we were not able to tie it out, but the number progression made sense, and because of the age of the biennial PURPA filing, it made sense to update it in this case. The information used in this filing is updated through December 2006. Again, the items such as the incremental energy costs were derived from the company's ProSim model, which is similar to that used by MDU. We would just recommend approval of the filing.
Thanks very much. Are there any questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? I might have one for either Mr. Jacobson or anyone from Excel. How does this rate compare with, you know, the historical rate that's been given for this this power? And I don't specifically need, you know, exacting numbers, but rather give us an idea of the progression of how this rate has moved.
Yeah, I have that, Commissioner. For the occasional delivery energy service, the previous metering charge was $3.50, and proposed in this case $3.75. And I would note that although the costs for the metering have changed, the company did not move to full cost. They moved somewhat less in order to avoid rate shock. That was their explanation of that. Payment for energy delivered to the company, again, for the occasional delivery energy service, moved from 2.41 cents to 5.03 cents. For the time of delivery energy service, the meter charge went from $4.50 to $4.75. On-peak payment for energy delivered per kWh from 3.47 cents to 6.82 cents. For off-peak energy per kWh, 1.82 cents to 4.06 cents. And the capacity payment went from 6.1 tenths of a cent to 7.9 tenths of a cent.
Mr. Jacobson, you know, some of these numbers are quite a jump, particularly in the energy charge. In some cases, more than doubling, a couple instances, more than doubling. Is that driven by any particular factors?
Well, actually, it's driven mostly, because we're talking about avoided cost payments, it's primarily due to the, if you want to call it fuel cost or energy cost. And that's the primary driver in this instance. You can tell that the capacity payments are relatively small if you are on the time of delivery energy service. There are only two customers on either of these rates, and they are both on the occasional delivery energy service, one being a windmill in Canova and one windmill in Carthage, South Dakota. Yes, it is a significant increase. We've seen similar increases in, for instance, our fuel adjustment clause. It's been very volatile, and, you know, this is indicative of those price movements.
And obviously volatility would be driven quite a bit by natural gas prices. Is the increase in the rate, I mean, obviously this doesn't quite deal with volatility. This has to do with an overall increase in the price of power as well. Is that driven by natural gas prices?
Well, it is to a degree. But, for instance, the primary rate that changed is denoted in the filing as the estimated system average incremental energy cost. Understand that, for instance, in the fuel clause, it reflects an average energy cost of what's experienced or expected to be experienced. When you talk about the incremental cost, you're talking about the facilities that are being used at any particular time and what would be avoided. For instance, incremental costs tend to be higher because, you know, that is the last unit that you're using, not an average. For instance, even with in-gas turbines, some have higher efficiencies than others. Normally, they would fire the most efficient plants first, and the lower efficient ones would be tend to be the incremental type of plants. So when you talk about incremental plants, you're talking about probably the least efficient plants and heat rates and stuff like that. That tends to drive the rates higher than what are reflected, for instance, in the fuel clauses would be an average rate. So incremental is higher. But, for instance, in response to a question that the staff asked, the marginal costs estimated of the model are based on different dispatched marginal units, including peaking units, combined cycle units, market purchases, and occasionally certain coal generation during off-peak. In other words, during shoulder months, you might have coal-fired facilities available for what would be your avoided cost or your incremental cost. During the summer peak, obviously, as you use more of your capacity up, you're talking about probably your most expensive capacity at that time. It's measured throughout the year, but in all cases, it's still the incremental cost, so it's probably the most expensive of any particular type of generation. So.
Thanks very much, Mr. Jakes. Another commissioner or advisor questions? Yeah, commissioner.
Excuse me if I lose my train of thought as I'm asking a question. I've been listening to what you were explaining and seeing whether or not that would answer the questions I have. A little bit challenged on trying to understand as I look at this, there are charges assessed to the generators, and there are also payments being made to those generators. And I was trying to figure out whether or not those seem to balance out, whether there was a good comparison, a rhyme or reason, if from a avoided or incremental cost basis. For instance, a wind generator was generating excess capacity, excess generation, and sending that into Xcel and being, is the price similar for what he's selling to Xcel as opposed to what he is buying from Xcel? I don't know that I phrased that quite well enough, but if I have excess capacity as a wind generator and I sell that into the system, into Xcel, in your opinion, is the amount that a wind generator would be purchasing then later on, if they're not generating enough electricity to fulfill their needs and they have to purchase electricity, does it seem, I know that you can't see exactly what the incremental cost is of what they're purchasing, but does it seem balanced to you?
Well, I mean, in one case you're talking about incremental costs, and another you're talking about averages. So, the customer would be on a particular rate. There's a couple different aspects of that. One is the incremental versus average difference that you're talking about. Obviously, regular tariff rates are not based on incremental costs. They're based on average costs. So there is a difference there. The other is whether these particular rates, for instance, the time of day rate measures, differentiates between the time of day. So if a wind generator was generating at a particular time of day, the rate that they're purchasing electricity from the company at may not reflect that. So there, again, would be an imbalance.
Right. I understand that. That's why I didn't try to put my arms around all of those different things, the nuances of all of those things, and that's why I'm asking you and your crystal ball or infinite wisdom of experience if you see any imbalance here.
Well,
I guess the shortcut to the question is, do you think that the generator is paying too much for avoided cost?
You mean the company is paying too much?
Well, the generator, if there's an imbalance between those.
Well, it's really difficult to say without some type of study showing when power is generated by each side and what the costs, you know, are in each case and everything. to go through a study like that, I mean, is quite an involved undertaking. Obviously, I think the last time that really occurred was probably when these rates were originally approved.
All right.
And, you know, and in that case, the commission did not approve the same exact methodology for each company. We took into consideration each company's, you know, various methods. As I'm trying to recall now, the order is quite old, but the companies proposed different rate structures, and it was quite an involved proceeding. It was actually before my time, but I have read the orders, and they took into consideration all of those factors you're talking about. But the, you know, whether things have changed, I think fundamentally, I think things are probably the same as they were back then. And, I rely on the commission's decision from back then.
All right.
To offer an overall analysis right now is difficult.
Okay. If that's not obvious to you, then I'll accept it as not being terribly out of balance before we have to worry about it.
Well, yeah, if I saw something really wrong, I would not recommend it.
Thank you. I have if I may, Mr. Chairman, perhaps Mr. Chow or Mr. Zins, is that correct?
Yes.
Can answer the question. I'm curious to what extent the high cost is being driven by Minnesota's mandates that are already in existence. Do you have any feel for that you'd like to share with us?
Boy, that'd be really difficult to say. What Mr. Jacobson said is essentially correct, and that is these rates are driven by the marginal cost, which is the last plant, which is usually the most expensive one brought online in any given hour, and those tend to be gas now, and that's not necessarily from mandates. It's because nobody can build a coal or nuclear plant anymore, so everything is driven off gas prices now. And how much more might be added to that because of renewables, I have no idea. Relatively small, I would think, at least at this point.
Thank you very much. And just out of curiosity, do you have somewhat of a comparison of these rates with surrounding states?
Well, we certainly have those which would compare to our similar rates in Minnesota and North Dakota. We haven't really looked lately at what other utilities have for the comparable purple rates.
How do you feel that South Dakotans on these rates would compare with surrounding states?
I think they're very comparable. We do the analysis the same way. Without looking, I think they're comparable.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have one other question. I noticed that the meter charge for the occasional power is quite a bit lower, dollar lower, in fact, than for the time of delivery energy service. Why would that be?
Commissioner, there was some information that it's not available to you in the original filing. I asked that question of the company, and they supplied information that actually that the meter that's not labeled as a time of day meter is actually a dual delivery meter. It measures both what the customer is sending the company and what the company is sending the customer. And from that cost, that's a significantly expensive meter. But because dollars are collected through the customer charge, they actually subtract from that the price of a regular, like, residential meter, so as not to double collect. But that's why, because it's a dual reading meter. It reads both ways for the company and the customer. So it's not just a simple residential meter or something like that.
And that wouldn't be the case for the occasional service as well? Wouldn't they also have an expensive meter that would go both ways?
I don't believe so. I'd let the company answer that.
Yes, this is John Charles. In effect, the company's meters used for parallel generations are like this area.
Mr. Chum, I'm going to ask you to hold on just a second. We're not hearing you very well, so we're going to turn up the volume on our end a bit and then maybe ask you to speak up a little bit.
Okay.
Oh, that's much better. Go ahead.
Okay. The company does use the same type of meters for parallel generation applications like in this tariff. And they are more expensive, like Mr. Jacobs had mentioned, it's the bi-directionals. Basically, do more than meter one way of energy flow. Therefore, they are more expensive. That is the reason why we propose to increase the rate lower than the actual cost should have been to avoid the customer being pay for a sudden increase in price in the metering charge.
Okay. Other commissioner advisor questions?
Excuse me, it's Greg Ristoff. Commissioner, if I could, I don't know if it was clear for all that, but the occasional delivery rate does have a bidirectional meter that is very expensive, allows the power to flow both ways. Again, I think Dave explained it's not a simple meter. It actually does. The bidirectional flow meter actually does apply to the occasional delivery customer, and apparently that is an expensive piece of equipment.
I guess just out of curiosity, I look at these and the the time of delivery meter, even though it appears based on these numbers to be significantly cheaper, when I look at the rate than you've got down there, it's more. You know, its actual cost is less. And I guess I'm just wondering what's that all about? Is that just a legacy thing where you didn't want to have too big of an increase there, or what is that? Or is it a philosophical thing?
Part of it, like in the occasional delivery, we net out residential meters for purpose of avoiding double charging. Similar for time of delivery, we also netted out a time of day meter that used in the regular service. Therefore, the install cost of meter actually showing less because we are subtracting out a much more expensive time of day meter.
I think I understand that. I mean, bottom line is there are numbers then that are really used in the calculation that we're not seeing here. Because of subtraction of some portion of that meter cost that's attributable to or that you attribute to what a customer would have to pay anyway, if I'm understanding it right. Is that what the deal is?
There are also other accounting expenses involved, like meter reading. They are slightly more expensive.
I think the answer to your question is yes. There's for the time of day customers, you've got a netting out of an assumed time of day meter, which offsets a bigger part of the time of day meter than for a regular residential customer who would have a very cheap meter there otherwise.
Okay, thank you.
Other commissioner advisor questions?
Commissioner.
Yeah, go ahead, Commissioner.
This is Commissioner Kobach. I was just wondering, Mr. Wilcox, before these charges continue to go up and up, is there anything that is done in other states that we could do here to keep a handle on this? Obviously, the future in energy is very unpredictable at this moment. Is there something that we could do to keep it from getting away from us if we do approve the raise? And, are there things that we could focus on in the future?
Well, Commissioner, maybe if I could just explain again, these are two tariffs that we use to pay small wind developers, for example. So, the way these PURPA tariffs have been set up is that we would agree to pay them an amount equivalent to what it would have otherwise cost us. That's what they mean when they say avoided cost. And so, as Mr. Jacobson was talking about, that avoided cost varies from time to time or hour to hour, depending on whether it's natural gas or sometimes it could be even coal. But, I suppose if we are able to minimize our fuel expense in any hour, that helps to reduce that average over time. That would be my first thought.
I just want to make sure that this is available in the future. And if it gets too expensive, then through the tariff rates, it may be excluded as an option in the future. I was just curious as to how that would work.
Well, this is a tariff rate. It had been required, of course, by federal law in 1978, by federal the PURPA Act. I think going forward now, PURPA has been revised, so there's some question about, you know, how this might, I don't think that South Dakota is determined yet how we're going to go forward with PURPA rates either. But, as of right now, it is a tariff rate, and we come in, I think it's every other year, and update the avoided costs that we pay. And again, the other thing is that these are for smaller customers. I mean, I think it's limited to less than 100 kilowatt size. So if it's a larger wind farmer, then that would be on a contract basis.
Okay.
Now,
Commissioner, if I could, I think maybe what you're trying to ask is that in the mix of plants or generation that the company has, is there a difference between, for instance, if you had an awful lot of baseload plant, a lot more of your avoided costs would be based on baseload plant. If you rely on gas turbines a lot more, then obviously a bigger percentage of your load at peak times is going to be served by gas turbines. Is that optimal mix determinable? Again, I think, you know, every company can support what they're doing, but it's certainly open to analysis. At one point, do you want to add something like a Big Stone 2 versus another turbine or something like that? I mean, it's just, it's a question. And every company, they're not all exactly the same. They're all somewhat different. So.
I just want to make sure that something doesn't get priced out of the market to avoid, which would take care of some of our options in the future. So. Thank you.
And I don't, the last FERC decision I think I saw indicated that anything under 20 megawatts, even if it's located in the footprint of an ISO, would be still considered a qualifying facility. I think that's right. Presumed to be part of a qualifying facility, still if it's even in the footprint. Yeah, and Mr. Wilcox, as you alluded to, this is, you know, good news, bad news. The good news is the higher this rate goes, that's more money in the pockets of South Dakotans who happen to have a wind turbine. The bad news is that means other energy sources in Xcel's mix are more expensive than they were. So, good news, bad news. Any other additional comments or questions by commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, is there a motion?
I'll motion in the case of EL07001 that the commission approve the revised rate sheets.
I'll second.
Concur.
Motion carries. At this time, and I probably should have stated this before we had a few people leave the room, but I think it would have been appropriate to move to the telecom portion of the docket. But I see Mr. Coy. Okay, let's look a little further down the agenda to see if we can get something else that might make sense. Perhaps we can move to, if we can move to telecom item number 8. That would be in the matter of, is there any reason that we wouldn't be able to take that? We apologize for jumping around, but let's go ahead and take up telecom item number 8. That's TC06-188. That's in the matter of the application of MCC Telephony of the Midwest, doing business as Mediacom, for a COA to provide inter-exchange and local exchange services in the Brookings Exchange. The question is today, shall how the commission proceed at this? I'm not quite sure what that question alludes to, so perhaps I'll look to staff, Ms. Van Bakkeren or Mr. Solem, to give us some indication where we're headed.
This is Kara Van Bakkeren for staff. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Staff requested that this question be placed on the agenda for a couple different reasons. We're working under some time frames, and there's a group of dockets here that deal with some of the same questions, and we're working under some set time frames, and staff is looking for some assistance from the commissioners as to how we should proceed so we can meet all the requirements as they fall under those time frames. These dockets all involve some new questions, new issues, new services to South Dakota. I just want to be sure all parties can adequately get all their questions answered. They can feel that they have been able to fully explain themselves, and staff can then therefore fully analyze the issues. So the first thing I guess staff would like to indicate is that at this point the applications do not appear to be complete. We did receive some new information from MCC yesterday and haven't had time to fully investigate their revised COA application. It may indeed be complete at this time and therefore the time frame start running, but we're not sure at this point and can state that it doesn't appear as if applications are complete. So in working under those time frames, staff believes that it would be best and recommends that staff work with the parties and coordinate the creation of some sort of a procedural schedule. It appears as if we're going to proceed through the hearing process on these dockets. Unless the parties can come up with a settlement and agreement, it looks as if we're going to proceed through the hearing process. So staff is just looking to commissioners at this point, I guess, to okay it that we move forward with the parties and try to create a procedural schedule and work towards that end.
I mean, it's not typical for, you know, staff and parties to request an okay from the commission before they go about setting a, you know, an agreed upon procedural schedule. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason you need sign off from the commissioners at this time?
I guess that in speaking with Mr. Singer, we thought that because the COA application usually proceeds a bit differently and staff is usually able to investigate, work with the parties, and have a recommendation for the commissioners at a regularly scheduled meeting. This is a bit different, and because there are so many new issues that we need to fully investigate, felt it was best to proceed through the hearing process, and because it's a bit different, thought we should put it on the agenda and get the okay. And Mr. Singer may have more to add.
Go ahead, Mr. Singer.
One thing I think I need to clarify is that, and I can't remember the law number, but one of the SDCLs gives the commission 60 days to act on a completed application. So once we receive a completed application, the commission has 60 days to act upon that application. If a hearing is needed, which we firmly believe that will be the case in this situation, we have 120 days to act. That's the time frame we're looking upon now. One of the reasons why we wanted to bring this before you is because these dockets were filed on October 24th, November 6th, and there's several of them actually that we're looking at. Karen referred to they were filed at different times, but it's staff's belief that these applications, at least upon originally filed, were not complete. Now MCC has responded to the data. Sprint responded to their data request some time ago, but they referenced to MCC's application, and some of the things that they referenced to weren't complete on MCC's. We did receive a response yesterday. We have not had time to evaluate whether or not that's complete. So what we're kind of looking for here is an understanding from the parties and to inform the commission that it's staff's belief that we do not believe the applications are complete at this time, so no one's going to be under the assumption that the 120-day clock didn't start back in November when this whole thing took place. The other thing is how do we determine when the application is complete? Do you want to give staff that power to determine, or should we come back before you? Should the parties all agree to it? We're just looking for some guidance on how to proceed on this, because this is, we are treading on unpaved roads here on going into the service territory of a rural ILEC, or several rural ILECs, actually.
And it's probably worth noting, it would have made more sense for me to jump Telecom 6 rather than Telecom 8, but I think we're discussing in general how to proceed with Telecom Items 6, 7, 8, and 9, which deal with the application of Sprint Communications to provide local exchange services in some rural areas for both TC06, 178, and 180, and then for MCC telephony for TC06, 188, and TC06, 189. So... perhaps at this time it would be appropriate to hear from any of the parties. I know we've got some interveners. I know we have some applicants. Other comments by other parties?
Thank you, Commissioner Brett Kennecke from MediaCom. It would be my position that the amended application filed yesterday afternoon is complete. I think that's the case. And if staff hasn't had time to review it, I understand. It's not like I was beating down their door last week or a month ago with the amended application. But I think it is. We had extensive data requests to respond to, and the coordination of those data requests with Sprint is provided and maybe more difficult than any of us anticipated. But I think at this point we're getting framed up and ready to go. I appreciate staff's position, and I appreciate what they've done for me this far in the process and my client. But I think we're at the point where it's time to get going with this docket and head forward, all four of them, in some way, shape, or form. So I appreciate having this on the agenda today and a chance to just have a brief discussion about how we do that. Thank you.
Commissioner, this is Mary Sasak. May I comment?
Yes, please.
I don't think that I was served with the amended application. Swiftel has been granted intervention in this case, and so I have not had an opportunity to review anything additional that was filed and come to an independent conclusion as to whether or not Swiftel would have further comments on whether the application was complete.
Well, I think that's a good point, and obviously that's a factual determination that I don't think we have. Whether or not the application is complete remains to be seen, but one would think you certainly should have been served. Perhaps we'll just pause to get a feel for whether or not that's on the way, or... Yeah, Mr. Kennecke has indicated non-verbally or a little bit verbally off microphone that it should be headed your way shortly. Did you have something else, anything else to add, Ms. Sisak?
Well, no, except that thank you for clearing that up. I guess I would, if there's going to be a question, it sounds like there's a question as to whether or not the application is complete, and if that is something that the interveners are allowed to comment on, then obviously we would need some additional time to receive the information and review it and make our comments.
Well, I'm no attorney, and so I'll certainly, one of them will knock me to the ground, but I don't think our intention today is to make any sort of a determination as to whether or not that application is complete, but that certainly interveners as well as staff would have additional time to review prior to, the commissioner or anybody else making that determination.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Other comments from parties to any of these dockets?
Mr. Chairman, Talbot Wisorek.
Yeah, go ahead, Dennis Wisorek.
As I understood your comments earlier, is that you're kind of lumping in number 6 and 7 in this discussion, so if I could comment now.
Sure, go ahead.
What I hear staff saying is they anticipate the need for a hearing on MCC, and impliedly, I guess, Sprint would fall within that given the way these dockets are arranged. I think it probably makes sense for the parties to get together and try to schedule something out, and it simply makes sense to assume maybe the 120 days clock is starting to tick, so we do it within that time frame. I don't think that puts any party in a position to objecting to whether a certificate is the application is complete or not. I think they can object along the way on that. I want the commission to be aware, though, that Sprint has a certificate of authority through a former commission's order, and we're in a slightly different legal position than MCC and what standard we have to be held to and what we have to prove. Even with that said, though, Sprint is contemplating and has had some initial conversations with MCC as whether it doesn't make sense to consolidate these dockets for the purpose of procedural schedule and potentially even for the purpose of an evidentiary hearing. And I would anticipate, and when I say consolidate, I would consolidate the two Swiftel-related dockets and the two ITC, but not all four together. That would seem to allow the parties better timing where they only have to come to Pier once, and Swiftel will only have to show up once to deal with both MCC and Sprint, and it would seem to be easier to get on the commission schedule probably to do it that way. So it's Sprint's intent to file a request to consolidate along those lines here in the next week or so. So with that said, I don't see any problem with trying to get this set in a 120-day time frame, so and everybody get their applications and move these things along.
Thanks, Mr. Zorek. Mr. Coit is at the mic.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, we are an intervening party in each of these dockets. We would concur with staff with respect to the initial filings and the initial filings not being complete. And we also agree that there's going to be a need for a procedural schedule. Exactly what that may consist of, at this point, we're certainly not sure. But there are some new issues here. There are some issues that are certainly issues of first impression. And so there are going to be issues that we're certainly going to want to provide some input on, which is as well as other parties. So we agree that we should work towards a procedural schedule.
Thanks, Mr. Coit. I do know that we have counsel for ITC also on the line. Would Ms. Moore, Mr. Overcash, anyone else care to comment?
Well, Mr. Commissioner, this is James Overcash. You know, I think there's a consensus from the standpoint of parties coming up with some type of a procedural schedule to stay within the 120-day time frame. ITC would obviously be, you know, supportive of working out some type of procedural schedule that does that, that we can bring back to the commission based upon, you know, staff's determination that the initial filing is appropriate.
Thanks very much. Mr. Singer, Ms. Van Bakkern, are you specifically looking for anything from the commissioners, or did this discussion take care of what you wanted us to do?
This is Kara Van Bakkern for staff. Would you like for us to come before you again when we believe that the applications are completed, or should we just proceed and staff, as Mr. Singer indicated, have the authority to make such a call?
You know, if it would... Unless there would be some objection, perhaps it would be appropriate for the three commissioners to instruct commission counsel to, you know, convene a meeting to discuss and put together a procedural schedule. Would that be appropriate, Ms. Van Bakkern?
I believe so. Mr. Singer, any additional comment?
Yeah, I think that would be appropriate. Well, one other thing I do want to indicate is that even though 120 days seems like a long time, really it's not a very long time at all. Considering, you know, if you give 30 days for response on a discovery request and then some additional time to review and everything. So even though the application may be completed, and when staff believes the application is completed, whether or not the parties are ever going to agree to a completed application or not, I'm not sure. But one of the things that we'd even discussed real briefly is there a possibility that the parties may agree just to waive that 120 days, because clearly that 120 days is there for the protection of, in this case, it'd probably be MCC and Sprint, even though Sprint has raised a little bit of a question whether or not they even believe they fall under this 120 days, but apparently, since, you know, there's some discussion about consolidating them, I think since MCC clearly does fall within that 120 days, that you know, maybe they'd fall under there. But that's another thing that we thought about, and don't know what the parties are feeling there. But there's a lot of issues here to sort through and talk about. Even though the application would be complete, staff still has additional questions. In fact, going through these briefly, there's some more concerns and questions that we do have, and a lot of things to consider. So,
thanks very much. Does anybody else have any other comments, any of the parties? Any comments or questions by commissioners or advisors? If not, perhaps, and I don't know if a formal motion is necessary, but, you know, it certainly can't hurt. I would move that we instruct you know, Commission Council, you know, we used to convene a meeting for the purpose of putting together a procedural schedule and move forward in that way. For all four dockets, and of course we're not dealing with consolidation at this point, but it would instruct General Counsel to do that in each of these four dockets. That's TC-06178, TC-06180, TC-06188, and TC-06189.
I'll second that motion.
I concur.
Great, thanks very much. With that, we will go back to the front of the agenda. Under electric, item number 2, we have EL07-003, and that's in the matter of the filing by Mid-American Energy Company for approved tariff revisions. And as one might imagine, the question for the commission today is, shall we approve the tariff revisions? And at this time, we would look to Mid-American, Gene Callaghan and Marv Sorensen. Anything
yes.
to any comments?
Yeah, this is Gene Callaghan. What Mid-America has filed here is its electric tariff, which display the sample customer bill. And what we're requesting is really just a change in the late payment language on that customer sample bill, and it will come to the customer as well. This revision does not change how the late payment charge is calculated or when the customer actually has to pay it. What we're trying to do here is clarify the language itself to the customer, and with that, we'd like to get approval from the commission to do that.
Ms. Callaghan, I didn't notice any substantive differences between, you know, this and the natural gas back at NG07-001. I think there's any problem taking these up together?
No, they're supposed to be the same.
Great, thanks. We'd look to staff for any comments.
You know, after what Gene just commented on, I really can't add anything. This is quite an easy filing, clarifying some word changes. One thing I will say is that Mid-American is asking for a February 13th, 2007 effective date. That is today. And staff would just recommend the approval with that effective date.
Commissioner Hanson?
Well, I would just like to say it's my understanding that the bill is... the late payment warning is easier, perhaps, to understand, and that they use larger type. Is that correct?
I don't know if that it's larger type. It's just the fact that the clarification of when the charge will go on the customer's bill, it talks about it being applied to the next bill. That's when the customer will see it if Mid-American doesn't get the payment within the 20 days.
Well, thank you very much. I thought that it included some larger type. I was going to say thank you for that. As I get older, I appreciate more and more larger type on those small type bills. But if it's not, I'll let you work on that for the next year.
Well, you may have received something that's larger than what I did because I get a form of it to put on my tariff here, and a lot of times it looks small to me.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other commissioner or advisor questions? Or comments? And again, we're dealing both with electricity number 2 and natural gas number 1. If there are no other questions or comments, motion would be in order.
Move for approval on EL07-003 and TC04-126. And G07-001.
Second. I concur.
And on my motion, I did not intend to include the telecommunications 04-126, just to, as a clarification.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
I'm sure those folks.
Yeah. Mid-States is already off the line. Done. Next on electricity number 3, EL07-004, it's in the matter of the filing by Ottertail Power Company for approval of an electric service agreement for the supply of bulk interruptible power between Ottertail Power Company and Valley Queen Cheese Factory Incorporated. And the question for the commission is today, shall the commission approve the tariff revision? All right, let's move to Ottertail Power. Mr. Ross, are you handling this?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, what we have is we had a contract with Valley Queen Cheese out of Milbank. It was a contract with the deviations. We had it filed with the Public Utilities Commission, and the contract had expired at the end of the year. We had asked for an extension, which was granted. during that time, in discussions with Valley Queen Cheese, they have decided that they would not like to continue on that bulk interruptible rate for their main plant. And probably the basic reason is that they it comes down to economics. When they run their generator at $2 a gallon for fuel oil, it computes out to about 16 cents a kilowatt hour. And last year, 2006, we controlled the plant for about 380 hours. So the savings that were on that bulk interruptible rate were pretty well eaten up with the additional fuel costs that they had. So they opted or are asking for approval. We concur with that to come off the bulk interruptible rate. And they would go on our large general service rate, which is a tariff rate.
Thanks very much, Mr. Ross. At this time, taking questions, we'll turn to Mr. Jacobson, Mr. Solem, or Ms. Kramer to see if there are any staff recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, this is Nathan Solem with staff. Mr. Ross has pretty well covered this. Staff would just recommend that this tariff revision be approved.
Thanks very much. Hard to imagine the public interest being hurt very much by somebody going from a contract with Aviations to a tariff rate, certainly. So any commissioner or advisor comments or questions? Hearing none, does anyone have a motion? I would move the commission approve the tariff revision.
I'll second.
I will concur.
Motion carries. Moving now to telecommunications, item number one is TC04-126, a matter of the filing by Midstate Telecom Incorporated for approval of revisions to its interstate switched access tariff. And the question is, today, shall the commission not require a refund with interest, and shall the commission close the docket? And this is has tied in with a number of other actions by the commission in the last few months, and so I don't know if Mr. Best, Ms. Kramer want to take it first, or if Midstates does.
Mr. Chairman, this is Harlan Betts with staff. The present Midstate rate is 11.5 cents, and the LECA plus rate, as determined by the settlement stipulation, is 12.25. And since the Midstate rate is less than the 12.25 that came up, and in accordance with the other commission actions that were taken in approval of those stipulations wherein there was no refund made, staff would recommend that there be no, that Midstate not be required to do a refund here.
Is anyone representing Midstate on the line or here in Pierre?
Wendy Harper with Vantage Point.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, sir. We do agree with staff with their recommendation.
Okay, thanks very much, Ms. Harper. Any commissioner or advisor comments or questions? Hearing no comments or questions, does anyone have a motion?
Move for approval on TC04-126.
I'll second.
I will concur that not require a refund and also close the docket. So that motion carries, and we'll move to item number two, TC04-127, a similar filing. It's in the matter of the filing by Northern Valley for approval of revisions to its interstate switched access tariff. And again, the questions are, today, shall the commission not require a refund with interest, and shall the commission close the docket? Mr. Best?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In this case, I would request that James Groff, who's manager of Northern Valley, explain to the commission when he would propose that that Northern Valley would implement the 12.25 that the LECA rate has come up with, since his company has a rate. They phased in a stipulation wherein on July 1st of 06 they had a rate of 12.5 cents, and July 1st of 07 it falls to 11.5. And in this case, since the LECA plus rate is less than their present rate, they need to reduce their 12.5 to the 12.25. And depending upon how soon that goes into effect, that might impact as far as if there should be a refund or not.
Okay, this is James. I agree with Harlan as far as the comments he made on the rates we have right now and when they're effective. Basically, what the issue becomes is as of January 1st of 07, our rate slightly exceeds the LECA Plus rate. And so the question becomes, do we make it effective upon commission approval or back to the first of the year? I guess I would offer up that either way it doesn't amount to a lot of money. It's a minimal amount. From our side, our preference would be to just make it effective with commission approval, just from a standpoint of not needing to take our staff's time to go back and recompute any amounts that would end up being minimal and applying to carrier's bill. So we prefer to just do it going forward. If the commission decides otherwise, it's not a real big issue or big inconvenience to us either way.
Thanks, Mr. Graft. Mr. Best, Mr. Graft, I mean, have we, this would have been a good question to ask in the previous docket too, but I mean, have we heard concerns with regard to, you know, IXCs, folks paying the switch to access tariff, they believe that a refund would be necessary or appropriate?
This is Harlan Best with staff. I have not gotten any inquiry from any IXC as far as their feeling that they're entitled to a refund.
Nothing from our end either, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thanks very much, Mr. Graft. Mr. Best, does staff have any concerns with not requiring a refund and making the effective date, you know, today as opposed to January 1?
I agree with Mr. Graft that what we're talking about here is a quarter of a percent, quarter of a cent. So it's, unless you have an awful lot of minutes, it's not going to have that much of an impact. The concern is that staff has is this 12 and a quarter rate should have gone into effect on 1/1/07 consistent with the LECA Plus rate. The LECA rate going in at that point in time. It was one of those things that kind of fell off the radar screen in the joy of getting all those switched access dockets taken care of, where this one with a phased-in rate had a different timing pattern associated with it as opposed to Midstate, and also with SS Telecom. Because that one also went directly to the 11.5 cents.
I mean, in that situation, and you know, this conversation probably isn't fruitful, but you know, in that situation, I mean, did any particular party or I mean, who would have had the burden to bring forth, you know, this this issue, or to make sure that rate went into effect 1/1/07?
Commissioner, if I may, I'm going to back up just a little bit and add a little bit of clarification because I think we're getting down. I think we have a little bit of a misunderstanding here. This docket that is before you today is a docket that approved an interim rate back in 2004 sometime when LECA came forward and asked for an interim rate. Northern Valley came forth and says, okay, we want that interim rate too, subject to refund with interest. Those dockets continued to pile up, and then when LECA actually settled those dockets, then we knew what the final rate was. LECA didn't have to provide a refund, and according to what we're looking here is for that time frame, Northern Valley, the CLEC here, probably doesn't have to have a refund too. Now we got to look at it a little different time frame too. When Harlan was talking about the 12.5 cent and the 11.5 cent rate, that is a rate that came after that. There was probably an 05 docket. I can't remember the docket number, where Northern Valley and staff came to an agreement to phase the rate down to 12.25 and then to 12.5, then to 11.5. So this refund specifically here, what we're talking about is the refund on the time frame when when Northern Valley was charging an interim rate. We're also tying into it here, I think, by mistakenly, is the fact that also now, because of that 05 docket where they agreed to take the 12.5, and now since the LECA docket, the LECA settlement, the new rate should be 12.25. And within that settlement agreement in the 05 docket, it says in there point blank, at no time shall the rate that Northern Valley is charging exceed the LECA plus rate. And yes, that should have taken place in January 1 when the LECA rate went into effect. And I don't know whose responsibility it was to catch it. I agree with James Groff that it is an immaterial amount, and, you know, essentially however the commission wants to handle it, I think Harlan has kind of indicated and staff has indicated that I think we're fine with that. But technically, the way the settlement reads, that James Valley should have automatically implemented that rate January 1st. And the previous docket is different because they never had a 12.5 cent rate. They went directly to 11.25. You had mentioned something there. I just want to clarify that too.
And Mr. Chairman, this is James again. I would agree with Keith. I would say technically, by the terms of the stipulation, the rate should have been the 12.25 at the first of the year. And again, if that's what the decision is, that's fine. It's immaterial enough where it would be easier to just make it effective going forward.
Sure, and I'll thank Mr. Singer for the clarification. I mean, it is worth pointing out that the previous docket is a different set of circumstances. That's good. Other commissioner or advisor comments or questions? Is there any motion?
I'll motion in the matter of TC04127 that the commission not require a refund with interest and the commission close this docket.
I'll second.
I concur.
It occurs to me all the way back in the Mid-American tariff filing, it was requested that we explicitly talk about an effective date of today. I don't know if that was explicitly noted. Does anyone want a revised motion, or was it understood that the effective date was today?
I can revise my motion. I guess I was under that opinion that Mr. Groff agreed to that.
Oh, no, I'm talking about, I'm sorry, I'm hopping around because I just looked over my notes and I'm talking about the Mid-American tariff, their billing. Because they had specifically requested an effective date of today. Maybe it's not necessary. We're probably fine.
I think it's just understood. It was mentioned. I mean, if you guys want to amend, but, yeah, I mean, clearly the order will have February 13th in it.
Sure. All right, good. I think we are squared away in all of our docketed items up to this point. Let's proceed to Telecom 3, TC06. Thanks very much, Mr. Groff. TC06-066, it's in the matter of the Section 272 biennial report for Qwest Communications International. The question is, today, how shall the commission proceed? I'd look to Mr. Best or Ms. Kramer. Can you summarize that report in less than 4 hours? Go. Go ahead.
This is binder one. Binder two is the same size. Under section 272 of the 47 USC, it's 47 USC section 272, separate affiliate safeguards. They're required for the holding company, in this case, Qwest International, if they have an inter-LATA or the origination of inter-LATA services, manufacturing activities, and for inter-LATA information services other than electronic publishing and alarm monitoring services. That's what they have to have fall under the Section 272. What the FCC and the 14 state commissions got together and created was a group that looked over the audit that was required under 272D for the Bell Operating Company and its Section 272 affiliate. If they've operated in accordance with the accounting and non-accounting safeguards required in Section 272 of the Act. The period covered by this is the second audit. The first audit was done in the 02, included calendar year 02, 03, and January 1st of 04. This audit covered the period from January 2nd, 04, to January 1st of 06. It's the responsibility of Quest Communications International, Inc.'s management to be in compliance with the 272 requirements. And the audit does not express an opinion on the compliance, just that it gives the, if the audit team finds anything, they explain it to Quest International. Quest International has a time opportunity to respond and explain why they did what they did or how they will correct what is found to be not in compliance with the requirements that are set forth in the by code. Interested parties are then given 60 days to file comments once the audit is completed, and that the audit was filed with the commission on June 9th of 06. Interested people were given 60 days in which to respond, so they could respond with comments by August 30th of 06. No comments were received by the commission. Staff would recommend that the that this docket then be closed.
Thanks very much, Mr. Best. Perhaps we'd look to see if anyone from Quest online has anything to add.
This is Jason Topp from Quest, and I think that Mr. Best has summarized this state of play very well with respect to this, and we would certainly support his recommendation of closing down this docket.
Great. Thanks very much, Mr. Topp. Any other comments? Everybody would have had their opportunity up until August 1st to comment, but does anybody else have any reason why the commission should not close the docket? Okay, any commissioner questions or comments? Or advisor questions or comments? Hearing none, I would move that the commission close TC06-066.
Second.
I'll concur.
Motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Best and Mr. Topp. TC-065 is next on the commission's agenda. It's in the matter of the petition of Sprint Communications Company, LP, for arbitration pursuant to the Telecom Act of 96 to resolve issues relating to an interconnection agreement with ITC. And the question before the commission today is, shall the commission grant the petition for reconsideration and clarification? We've received the filing by Mr. Coit, as well as response by Mr. Wazorek. And at this time, we'd look to you, Mr. Coit, for your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, if it's okay, I would offer that we argue these together, 175 and 176. I think the arguments are pretty much the same.
Absolutely. I think that would be very efficient. So at this time, we'll also take up TC-06-176. And, of course, the questions are the same. Shall the commission grant the petition for reconsideration and clarification? And proceed, Mr. Coit.
In filing this petition, just a couple of remarks that I'd like to make. The petition itself is pretty brief and straightforward, but I would like to note a couple of other things that I came across as I was doing some research and trying to decide what action we should take after being denied intervention. Up front, I guess I would just say that we really don't agree with the commission's decision to deny us intervention. We've asked for this clarification as kind of a different approach, given the concerns that we have with respect to being able to provide some input in the process and make the commission aware of the, I guess, the potential impact of some of the issues that are presented in the arbitration proceeding. One of the things that was noted in the response of Sprint, we have attached some Minnesota rules and also a Minnesota PUC order dealing with an arbitration over there that occurred back in the mid-1990s, shortly after the 96 Act was passed. Particularly, there's a rule that's relevant, and there's an indication in that rule that intervention is not permitted in arbitration proceedings over in Minnesota, and that is correct. Just to shed a little more light, though, on that particular point, I would like to note that there are other states that do permit some intervention under their rules in arbitration proceedings. So you don't get the impression that all states do the same and that the rules in other states support the decision here. Colorado is one that allows for intervention in arbitration proceedings, and the particular rule is section 2564, parens B. And that does say a person seeking to intervene on a petition shall file a motion to intervene within 10 days of the date that the petition for arbitration was filed with the commission. A person may submit public comment on the petition within 25 days of the date that the petition was filed with the commission. So there are provisions in Colorado that do allow for some intervention. In addition to that, the state of Washington includes some provisions that reference intervention in arbitration proceedings. It's specifically Washington Rules 480-07-630. That particular provision has kind of a special public interest standard for arbitrations. It says, arbitrations typically involve only the parties to the negotiation. Other parties may ask to participate, but will be allowed to do so only upon a showing of compelling public interest. The public counsel section of the Office of the Attorney General may elect to participate pursuant to, and that references another rule. So at least in the state of Washington, there is some circumstances where it's viewed as compelling enough to permit some intervention of other parties. The other one that I found, and I did not look and do a nationwide search, I think I probably looked at about 15 different states. And another one that appears to grant intervention in arbitration, at least under the rules, is New Mexico, and that's section 17.1.2.26. The reason I point that out is again, we really don't agree that we should have been denied intervention in this case. The issues are incredibly important to the rural industry, and I think I would ask the commission to keep that in mind as I comment a little bit more on the petition for clarification. We had considered appealing the commission's decision denying us intervention, and I gave it some more thought after doing some of the research and looking at some of the procedures that are set forth in some of these other states. And I did, in coming across Minnesota, it seemed that there was a reasonable approach to allowing some input on the part of other parties in the arbitration proceeding. If you go to the Minnesota rules that I've attached to the petition, there is the first rule, I guess, which is 7811.1700. And if you go to subparagraph 10, there's a provision in there that others wishing to participate may attend hearings as observers, file written comments, and request the opportunity for oral argument to the arbitrator or the commission as provided in part 7829.0900. Another thing, though, that I think is relevant, since that rule is somewhat brief, is this order that I found that is dated October 30th, 1996, and this involved a Sprint petition for arbitration involving Contel. And if you go to the second page of that particular attachment, paragraph D1, I'd like to read this. It says, the commission will also allow others to take part in the arbitration as non-party participants under Minnesota Rules Part 7829.0900. Participants shall have the right, after the hearing is closed, to file written comments and request an opportunity for oral presentations to the ALJ, the commission, or both. Participants may attend all hearings and pre-hearing conferences as observers. subject to the same confidentiality constraints as the parties. Participants shall also have access to all written information admitted as evidence in the arbitration, subject to the same requirements as parties with respect to confidential or proprietary data. I think that looking at that language and looking at the rule, we came to the conclusion that we needed a little bit of clarification from the commission with respect to our rule that involves the right to appear in commission proceedings as something other than an intervening party. That particular rule is section 20.10.01.15.06. The commission has, based on my involvement in the past in various proceedings, the commission is permitted the filing of written comments under that rule. I know that we have done that in some cases in the past. We filed written comments. We did not intervene, and those have been accepted. I think it would be important to understand that, you know, written comments are different than evidence in the proceeding, and I accept that fact. At least it provides for an opportunity to submit legal arguments, public policy arguments. I would also argue that with respect to public policy arguments, it certainly would not seem to be inappropriate given the fact that it's not evidence, and I believe this commission can distinguish between what's hard evidence and what's comment, that we could reference, information that you might view as information that the commission could take judicial notice of in a proceeding, or information that's disclosed in some other record before the FCC or some other state public utilities commission. We believe that that process is pretty reasonable. The commission's rule is not all that clear as to exactly what is permitted in a situation where an individual appears to provide some input in the process. In responding to some of the contentions or some of the arguments that Sprint puts forward, another one of the reasons we decided to go with this clarification within this form of asking for a petition for reconsideration or clarification is that if you recall, when the arguments were presented around the intervention, there was some discussion of this particular rule, this right to appear under the South Dakota rules, and I do recall that Mr. Wazorek specifically referenced that as at least some justification for the denial of the intervention, because we had some ability to receive due process through this other provision. In that context, because of the fact that it was discussed when the intervention was argued, we felt that this was a proper approach in making this filing. With respect to some of the other specifics, there's a claim on the part of Sprint that we have not disclosed our interest in the proceeding. I would not agree with that. We filed a petition for intervention, and I think we were pretty specific as to why we were interested in the process. We referenced specifically some of the particular issues that were raised in the arbitration. For the record, I guess we would ask that the commission consider our petition intervene incorporated in part of this particular petition for recon, for clarification. There's some reference to us being required to list our contentions, in this proceeding. I don't think that's what the rule requires. The rule references, at least the way the commission has interpreted this rule in the past, it allows people to appear and file comments either at the hearing or after the hearing. If the implication is that we should have to file in advance of the hearing all of our contentions, then why not make us a party? If we're a party, we'd be filing pre-filed testimony and so forth, but not being a party, I don't think it's all that reasonable to require the individual who's not a party, who's not going to be able to present evidence, to have to present all their written comments in advance of the hearing. We certainly want an ability to review the evidence that's presented at the hearing and make comments based on that review. So I don't see anything in the rule that specifically requires in advance of the hearing that we have to list all of our contentions in the proceeding or all of our arguments. I would guess that one of the most contentious issues, it appears from the response that's been filed, has to do with access to confidential information. With respect to the arguments that we should have access to no confidential information or not be able to sit in the hearing when any confidential information is being submitted, I think that ignores a couple of things. Number one, as you all know, I think parties are pretty liberal when it comes to designating what they view as confidential or proprietary information. So effectively, that throws the burden back on us of having to challenge if there's certain information that we think should not be viewed as trade secret or proprietary information. I also think it does not take into account the fact that the concerns that Sprint has can easily be addressed with a non-disclosure agreement or a protective order. We are very willing to limit access to the information. Matter of fact, at this point, I could say probably if anybody else is to have access to that information other than me, it may be the SDTA president, and that would be about it. I think certainly by just limiting the individuals who would have access to the information, limiting the purpose for accessing the information to this particular proceeding and presenting arguments in this proceeding is sufficient to protect Sprint's interest. I guess with that, I'll turn things over. The other thing is that it is not our intention to broaden the issues in this proceeding. We know what the issues are under the petition for arbitration, but certainly they have an industry impact, and we feel that we should have some ability within reason to comment on potential industry impacts. I understand that we can't go crazy and pull in a bunch of company-specific facts and so forth. But there is certain information out there in the industry that's in FCC filings, that's in other dockets that are pending or have been decided that this commission should be able to review, and that's really all we're asking for in this process, of being able to participate, offer some written comment, argument on legal issues, public policy issues, so forth.
Thanks, Mr. Coit. Rather than take questions at the time, we'll hold those until we've heard from all of the parties. Sprint, any response?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Talbot Wisorek. First, there's a number of things I want to hit on or touch, let me take them in order first of this issue of due process. He's thrown that term out, but I don't see anything in his filings where there's a constitutional due process that every affiliate company or every ILEC or every association has a right to participate in a proceeding. I think that's patently wrong on the law, and there is no guaranteed constitutional due process right for Mr. Coit to be in this hearing. Second, I'd like to talk about the confidential documents. Confidential documents are important, and the statement that SDTA's president needs to look at our confidential documents, I think, is a signal to me and to Sprint that these documents, that SDTA is going to see these documents, and they're going to be considered in how to deal with Sprint and other filings and what Sprint is doing to market its services and to compete with some of these companies that are members of Mr. Coit's association. Third, this argument that he doesn't have to set forth his contention flies in the face of the rule that talks about the taking into consideration his contentions when deciding whether they have a right to appear, because the rule requires that his contentions be reasonably pertinent to the issues presented. Well, if you look at Mr. Coit's contention in his incorporation of his request to intervene as a party, they are the broadest statements you can imagine, and they are identical in both of these filings, even though the issues in between the companies in these different filings is different. For example, one of his contentions is how to develop forward-looking economic costs. However, we have an agreement with ITC that we're going to start with balance of traffic, so that's not even going to be in evidence. I also find it interesting, I mean, Mr. Coit's trying to paint Sprint into a position where we're worse off with him appearing and filing contentions than if he was a party, because he is telling this commission he's reserving the rights, if you let him to appear, to cite to evidence in other proceedings. Number one, I don't. The rules of procedure and evidence allow this commission to take judicial notice of things in other proceedings, but that has to be done through a formal process during the hearing presented by a party subject to evidentiary questions. If you want to cite a legal decision, you can certainly cite that legal decision, but it would be totally inappropriate for a party, not let alone somebody who's just appearing, to file a brief and then cite to industry information to establish the rights between these two parties. What Mr. Coit appears to be doing, what SDTA's motivation here is to come in and, oh, as somebody might say, chicken little at the sky's falling, and look at how this terrible thing's happened to my industry. This is an arbitration between two parties. Sprint's conditions on Mr. Coit appearing and raising comments, I thought were fair and to the point that are going to be covered in this arbitration. Mr. Coit should set forth on behalf of SDTA which of these issues, we've gone through in each of these arbitrations and listed the issues that exist between these parties, which of these issues is he going to provide comment on? And his comments should be restricted to the parameters set out by the parties. It's inappropriate for him to come in and say, yeah, okay, these guys have agreed that they're going to decide this somewhere within these parameters, but I don't think that's right. He should be restricted and not broaden those issues. Yet he wants this commission to accept his contentions as the broadest, most general analysis you can get that he filed when he did his motion to intervene. Though, I mean, one of his contentions is he wants to discuss indirect interconnection versus direct interconnection obligations, period. I don't know what that means in relationship to these issues. Does SDTA claim they can come in and argue there is absolutely no obligation to indirectly interconnect? I think he needs to set forth, in relationship to the issues of these arbitrations, the issues laid out in the petition and the response, what he believes his contentions are going to be, and those contentions need to be within the confines set by the parties. As to the confidential information, the problem we have with confidential information is this commission's heard extensive arguments. This commission has decided some of the information is confidential and proprietary and important for competition. If you start allowing other parties to see it, not just even this party appearing council, but their president now, that opens up a whole range of issues as to how we can keep this information truly confidential, number one. Number two, it puts Sprint in a position that we have to be very aggressive as to what is put in the record. Now, in the initial pre-filing, an 80-page contract between MCC and Sprint was attached in both proceedings by the ILEC, witness for the ILEC, and only referred to in passing. Now, we have a significant problem with that. If they're going to be attaching a lot of our confidential information and only refer to it in passing in their testimony, is that really relevant for this proceeding if then that's going to open up this information to anybody who claims a right to appear? So that's why we put the confidential restriction on, and I think it's a legitimate restriction when somebody's coming in under only a right to appear. What Sprint wants to avoid is SDTA becoming a de facto party and throwing in evidentiary considerations and essentially being at the table where this commission's already decided they don't belong. And we think the restrictions placed in our submission for their right to appear are reasonable. It gives them the ability to submit comments. It gives SDTA the ability to discuss specific issues relevant to these arbitrations, not potentially relevant to any one of their members. And that's an acceptable way to allow SDTA, or an acceptable restriction to allow SDTA to submit comments. I don't see, and Sprint doesn't believe that the restriction on the information of confidential is going to impact SDTA's ability to submit its comments. That's very difficult to see, at least at this point, because we're not even sure where their issues, what issues SDTA has with it, what the parties have agreed to and what's left on the table. So for those reasons, I think the Commission actually should deny a right to intervene if SDTA refuses to go through the issues set for arbitration and give some idea of what its contentions are as whether those issues are appropriate or inappropriate. Second, if SDTA continues to argue that it can bring in industry-type information in its contentions, I think the right to appear should be barred too. Obviously, that's broadening the scope of the issues and allowing SDTA to bring in evidence that's not going to be subject to cross-examination and not subject to proper review in front of the Commission. That's all I'd have, Commissioners.
Thanks very much, Mr. Wazorek. At this time, perhaps we would see if ITC or Swiftel, if either of those parties have any comments with regard to the petition.
Chairman, this is James Overcash for ITC. In addition that we would be supportive of Mr. Coit's request to the Commission, I did want to provide, in my opinion, at least a clarification. I do not know of any decision that's been made by this Commission finding any of the information or documents that Sprint has provided as absolutely being confidential. We've operated under a confidentiality agreement, and we continue to operate on that. But I don't know any finding in terms of your making a finding that something has absolutely been determined confidential. I'd obviously disagree with Mr. Talbot's or Zorg's comments regarding our direct testimony, but I will not. I won't consume your time with responding to those comments.
Thanks, Mr. Overcash. Anyone from Swiftel?
Yes, Mary Sisak, and I. Swiftel also supports SDTA's request, and I agree with Mr. Overcash's understanding of the nature of confidential information in this proceeding. I believe what the Commission did do in one of our earlier meetings was to allow Sprint to redact certain information from its confidential document that it claimed to be highly proprietary, so none of the parties have it. And, of course, SDTA would not have it either.
Thanks very much, Ms. Sisak. Does anybody, I think those are the four parties, if I'm mistaken. If there's another, please step forward. But at this point, perhaps, before we take questions, Mr. Quaid, an opportunity for rebuttal?
Yes, please. I have a problem, I guess, with the position of Sprint here. It's almost as though they're trying to give everyone the impression that there is no industry position on these issues, that there shouldn't be any industry position on these issues. As we pointed out when we argued for intervention, there's a good reason for the industry interest in these issues, and there are industry positions on these issues that even today are being advocated in proceedings before the FCC, and in particular with respect to the Missoula plan. With respect to, information that we want to provide to the Commission, this Commission, I think, can tell the difference between written comments and evidence. They don't want us to be an intervening party, so we can't present any evidence. They also don't believe that we should be able to submit any written comment that isn't obviously very confined. When we brief cases, we don't reference just everything that was presented in the record. There's always reference to FCC decisions, other state commission decisions. This commission can also, if they feel that something is in a brief that shouldn't have been put in a brief, you have the ability to strike that. If you think that somebody's overstepped and is presenting information that isn't in the record, that isn't information that should be presented to you, even though it may be, you know, information that was presented in some other process somewhere that has been accepted as evidence by someone else, or is information that is of the general sort that gets submitted to the FCC. You know, the FCC doesn't even have a hearing process. They have a written comment process. That's pretty much all they do. And I don't think that you want to be deciding these sorts of cases without having some idea of what the FCC decisions are on various industry issues. And you know, we have an industry position on these issues, or we're developing those industry positions. To say that we shouldn't have any right to be an intervening party, and if you're going to file written comments, you really got to confine those written comments to this particular record or this particular evidence over here, that I don't think gives recognition to the fact that you can tell the difference between written comments and evidence. And I think that if you feel that somebody's overstepped or crossed the line, you have every ability to strike that right out and say you shouldn't have put that in your brief. It's not part of the record. We're not gonna allow any sort of reference for that. I don't think that that's been a real problem in briefing in the past, and I don't really see it as being a problem here. As far as us trying to get right up to the table, no, that's not what we're doing. I think if you read the Minnesota rules, I don't think that's what the Minnesota rules permit either. But I think they do permit some participation with the recognition that that party, that individual or that person appearing is not a party. They're not going to be able to cross-examine. They are going to be given some access to the record, so they have some ability to set forth their positions in a rational way and make their arguments. They want to handcuff us to the point that we can't even make our arguments. I would guess that most of the information in this case is going to be deemed confidential, or at least has been marked confidential. I'm not sure how we can make many arguments at all if we don't have some access to at least some of that information. So that's my response.
Chair was in error when moving to rebuttal before giving staff an opportunity to provide their comments. So my apologies. And if there's anything staff says, Mr. Quake, you think is you'd like an opportunity to rebut, certainly you'll have that opportunity.
This is Caravan Bachman for staff. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think in the previous decision made by commissioners there was ever a denial that there certainly is an industry position and that those industry positions are very important. However, it seems that the commission and staff really leaned on the fact that this is an arbitration between two parties. It's a contract negotiation between two parties. But that being said, individuals in general certainly do have an opportunity to appear under our Rule 20.10.01.15.06. So it seems to me the question then comes down to two questions. Who may be a party to appear, and what can that party do as a party to appear? And, you know, when Mr. Best and I first were looking at this rule, we questioned whether or not SDTA even fit into that rule at all. Well, when we look at all the South Dakota Code as a whole, clearly a person, an individual, a corporation falls under there. Okay, so past question number one. Now question number two is, what can this corporation do if it's allowed to appear? Not as a party to the case, it seems very reasonable that that party wouldn't, that individual that's now appearing, wouldn't have the opportunity to see that confidential information. That confidential information, as I understand it, would be that as marked as confidential, not necessarily there's a mention of the redacted portions that we went through in some motions regarding evidence earlier. As I understand it, that would just be that information submitted to the commission as marked confidential. And I don't see how as a party appearing, not as a party to the case that I would have access to that, not have the ability to appeal. It doesn't seem that there would be any ability to question witnesses throughout this process either. With all that being said, I definitely believe that those industry positions are important and can be briefed, and if the commissioners see fit, could be orally argued. And so you have the opportunity to understand those industry positions. However, it seems that those industry positions should all be within the confines of the agreement, whatever, however we look at it, between the two parties that are involved in this arbitration. So it does seem to staff, and it's in staff's opinion, that the specific issues should be within the confines of the two parties involved in the arbitration. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Van Bakkern. Questions for any of the parties by commissioners or advisors? I have some, but go ahead and pop in if you...
I guess that was one I was going to ask staff. Who constitutes confidential information? Is it solely the company, or does the staff have any control over what they deem confidential and what is not confidential?
Now, there are some rules regarding that, and I can find them here in front of me. That would probably be easiest. All party has to do for something to be confidential, as I understand it, and Elaine, please jump in, is simply mark it as such. And then if another party to the proceeding doesn't believe it is confidential, then they bring it before the commissioners. Is that correct? And then the commissioners have the opportunity to decide whether or not it is confidential.
Okay, so there's a little bit of a bar so that the company just can't mark everything as confidential and no one gets to see it. Although the other party would have to intervene and say and check off specific things that they feel is not confidential.
And not necessarily intervene. It would be one of the parties already to the case
wouldn't
believe that it was confidential. Okay.
All right. Mr. Coit, one of the disagreements between the parties with regard to your petition is how specific the contentions must be under the, Ms. Van Bakkern mentioned, well, who can be a party? Well, it's not just any person. And a person, it does appear they have to meet some basic thresholds of things they have to. They have to, have an interest. They have to state their contentions. Do you have a response to Mr. Wozorek's argument that your client's contentions have not been stated specifically enough?
Well, my first response to that would be, I just find it kind of strange that he's all concerned about what we might present when we really have been denied party status. We can't file pre-filed testimony. We're not going to be able to cross-examine witnesses. It's kind of hard, I think, from the standpoint of, at this time, particularly identifying what our particular contentions are going to be when I haven't even been served any of the pre-filed testimony. I guess I look at this particular provision on right to appear as really giving someone the right to go to the hearing, listen to the evidence, and make some comments and provide some input. I think that's what the intention of that rule is. Now, it seems to me that Sprint's trying to turn that around and say, well, if you're going to do this, then you need to indicate straight out what you're going to do. Well, I don't think the rule really calls for that. The rule calls for that, or the rules call for that from parties, but we're not a party. Which way do you want it? That's the way I look at that. Now, if it boils down to the fact that we need to provide a little more information to give an idea of what we might comment on after the hearing, another response to that would be they certainly can respond to our written comments. I'm assuming they are going to respond to our written comments. It's not like I'm going to be, I think the reason for pre-filed testimony is to allow parties to prepare cross-examination primarily, prepare arguments with respect to evidence. I'm not going to be involved in any of that. I'm not going to be involved in those arguments. My contentions would be forwarded in written comments, and they can respond in my written comments. But I'm assuming that's not going to happen until after the hearing's over. So what interest of theirs is protected by me filing stuff early? I'm not involved in the process anyway until after it's over.
So, Mr. Quitt, is it, I'm just trying to apply, try to determine how the rule should be applied. Is it your contention then that the contentions of the person, I mean, the commission has to make a determination whether or not the contentions of the person seeking to appear are reasonably pertinent. Do you think the issues raised in your petition to intervene were specific enough to give the commission a feeling that they're reasonably pertinent?
Yeah, I would. I believe that. Obviously, Sprint does not believe that. I also think that, again, we're talking about written comments. If the commission doesn't believe they're reasonably pertinent, I expect that you're probably not going to pay any attention to it. But you know, to me, it's like they want us to jump through these hoops to take advantage of this. And to protect what interest, I'm not sure.
And I understand, you know, the frustration that that you all have been put in. I mean, you feel it's an important proceeding and you want to be a part of it. I just am looking at the rule, and I believe that those words, when they were written, had to mean something. So I'm trying to figure out what it means when it says the contentions of the person have to be reasonably pertinent before they're allowed the opportunity to appear. Now, I understand what you're saying. You know, what does it matter? Can't the commission just throw it out? But, I mean, I got to believe these words mean something. And perhaps I'd look to staff to see Ms. Van Bockeren's take on what threshold has to be met.
I guess if I could just note one further thing there. If you look at this, and I think, you know, it was probably put together with the idea that somebody from the public might show up at a hearing and have something to say. And they didn't, you know, they didn't file an intervention, but they've got something to say. And so you're going to let them get up and they're going to say something. They may get off track. Okay? It's not then reasonably pertinent. What do you do with that person? I would think that you would probably say, well, you know, you better get yourself back on track here. You know, here's what the issues are. The problem that I have right now in setting forth a bunch of contentions is, as I mentioned, I have not seen any of the pre-filed testimony. I've not been provided anything at this point because I'm not a party. Now, could I have gotten some of that stuff off the commission website? Yeah, sure, I can get some of that stuff. I could provide probably some better idea of what our particular issues might be, but until I've actually heard the evidence and sat in and hopefully listened to witnesses and so forth, you know, I don't know how particular I'd want to get.
Thanks. Ms. Van Bockeren?
Oh, as I was just reading this rule, I didn't see how it related to pre-filed testimony, how it related to evidence. As I was reading it, I thought those contentions would be those contentions or industry concerns, as you referred to them earlier, as they relate to those issues identified by the parties in their petitions, even for this arbitration. There's clearly some differences in where the parties stand, and I can see how there's industry concerns as it relates to those previously identified issues, not as it relates to pre-filed testimony or evidence maybe.
But to what is the commission to look to be able to determine whether or not those contentions are pertinent? I mean, in this instance, we do have a petition for intervention, but that wouldn't always be the case. I mean, I'm not quite sure what this rule means.
And I always think the issues would be pertinent simply because they've been brought up by those parties to arbitrate. Am I understanding your question? If there are industry concerns as they relate to the differences in the arbitrating parties, well, I think that would be pertinent because they're pertinent issues between the arbitrating parties. So, I don't know. Does that make any sense? I'm talking in circles.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Wazor, go ahead.
If I could, I didn't articulate this as well in my argument as the staff has. And having listened to Mr. Coit, I think the big problem you run into where SCTA is at this position, SCTA is basically saying, I want to raise industry issues. Well, we are arbitrating between two parties. The industry issue on a certain matter could be a harder line than what ITC or Swiftel has taken in this situation. We shouldn't be in a position, i.e. Sprint, to have to argue against the industry position. We should only be talking about Sprint or Swiftel's or ITC's position. And that's when, if you read the rule and it talks about not broadening the scope, I don't hear SCTA saying that they're not going to broaden the scope. He wants to raise industry issues, but I'm with staff. Is Mr. Coit could have read the petition and he could have read the response. And he's going to know we got a dozen issues in each of these, and they're fairly narrow, some of them, and he should be able to say we're going to raise our industry issues on this one within the scope of this. This one, maybe we're not going to raise any issues on this issue because the parties are fairly close. But he shouldn't be able to take it out of the range pre-established by the party under this rule. And
Mr. Coit, I also have. I'm sorry, Mr. Wiswark, were you done?
Yeah, I'm done.
Thanks. Mr. Coit, I'm having a hard time figuring out how we could give interested parties access to confidential information. And you know, I guess maybe it makes sense in this instance. But what rules of thumb, what threshold should the commission use to say, well, these folks, you know, who want to appear can look at confidential information, but, I mean, does that mean that everybody who meets the thresholds to be able to appear would be able to look at confidential information? I'm not sure where we draw the line. I'm struggling with that a bit.
No, I think that is difficult. There was some reference to the Minnesota rules or the Minnesota order and it being 10 years old. There's nothing that I found, at least, you know, in the little bit of looking that I did. There's nothing that I found indicating that the procedures set forth in that Minnesota order are no longer valid and are being followed. That's just based on the research that I've done to this point. You know, I'm not going to say that I'm necessarily correct on that, but they found it reasonable in issuing that order. I'm not exactly sure why. It's not real specific. I do think that if the commission is going to continue down the road in these arbitration proceedings of limiting participation and never permitting intervention regardless of the level of interest, I think something has to change in the rules the way they're written. Because I don't think it's fair to say that these issues are not issues that have some industry impact. And the other thing with regard to the issues, you know, they're asking me to identify the industry issues. Well, you know, if you look at the arbitration petition, a lot of those issues are industry issues. Just as they're stated right now, pretty much, are industry issues. We're not going to try to bring in new issues. We're going to try to provide some industry perspective with respect to the issues that are there. And that's really what we want to do. I don't have any intention of bringing up new issues. Might there be some issues that we don't have any interest in because they're really particular to the terms of the contract? Sure. I'm sure there'll be a number of those. But, you know, with respect to some of the issues regarding sharing of, you know, or putting mixed traffic on trunk facilities, you know, what the transport responsibility of the ILEC is, how far outside of their service area they might have to haul the traffic. You know, those are industry issues in themselves. Those are issues that are being addressed in the Missoula plan. They're industry issues. So, you know, I could go through and I could say, okay, you know, this is why this is an industry issue and this is why it is. But I can't tell you today what my particular position might be on some of those.
And I understand, you know, your view on the contentions question. Maybe I'll back up a little bit. I mean, is it your belief that any individual customer or ratepayer that would be permitted by this commission to appear should have access to confidential information?
I think there's a decision the commission needs to make there. If the parties have taken the stance of really very liberally designating confidential information, it's very easy for them to eliminate any party's ability to offer arguments or input. If they've gone a step too far and they've declared so much stuff confidential, and the only way that I can get it non-confidential is to object
and say that, well, it's not trade secret, it's not proprietary information, it shouldn't be confidential. I think that's a problem. But I think, you know, when you're looking at confidential information, I think you look at the risk versus you look at, you know, the risk of disclosure versus, you know, the benefit of disclosure. And what additional arguments or whatever you might hear or what input you might hear that might permit you to make a good decision from a public policy standpoint or whatever. I think to say straight out we don't have any access to any information that they designate as confidential, it's going to hamper our ability. I don't think there's any question that it will hamper my ability to make arguments. I don't know particularly what to this point has been declared confidential and what hasn't. But, you know, I think it's a weighing process. That's my answer, I guess. And I think you have the ability to make those decisions.
I mean, is that decision totally subjective? Are there any standards that the commission should use to determine, okay, it makes sense for Rich Coit and his client to have access to confidential information, but a ratepayer, a customer of either Sprint or ITC or Swiftel, should not be allowed access to that confidential information? I mean, I understand the weighing. Aside from the subjective process, do you have any standards we should use?
Not really. I think it's pretty subjective. But I think it is a risk-benefit thing. And just looking at it from your perspective, you know, if you want valuable input or you want input that might help you with your decision, then I think it's a balancing process. And, you know, it wouldn't be the same for everybody.
Other commissioner or advisor questions or comments?
I have a question for staff, I guess, here. I'm going to need you to bring me back to home base here. Could you please tell me, if we were to grant the petition for reconsideration and clarification, what does that entitle Mr. Coit to? And if we don't grant it, what is he losing?
Well, Commissioner, in my opinion, if you grant it, he should have the right to access of anything posted on the Internet, anything that's public information in general, and to have the ability to, of course, sit through the hearing and hear everything that the public could hear. And in the end, brief the issues, the industry issues as he sees them, how they relate to the disagreement between the arbitrating parties, brief those issues, and even orally argue them if it would be helpful for the community. and you use that information, you use the argument, you use the brief in making your decision. And Mr. Coit would argue that he would like to have access to the confidential information that would pass between the parties involved in the arbitration, question witnesses. Was that one of, no? So it was just basically the confidential information. What am I missing, Mr. Coit?
I think that's pretty much it with what you said before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's kind of what's permitted under Minnesota. At least that's my understanding. You know, I don't know if Minnesota has changed those procedures, but based on that older order anyway, it looked like they'd actually permitted some confidentiality access.
And another issue is probably the broadening of the issues. And, of course, the brief would just be restricted to those issues that the parties presented. And without access to confidential information, it would be hard to broaden it anyway. So,
and if we weren't to grant the reconsideration and clarification, how would that differ from John Q. Public? We just wouldn't get the brief, correct?
No, it wouldn't differ because the public would have the opportunity to brief something anyway. So I don't think it's necessary to necessarily grant anything. I think what Mr. Coit was seeking was a clarification, and within that clarification was the ability to access confidential information. Without the clarification, I think we're all in agreement as to what John Q. Public can do in any case that sits before this commission as a public agency.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Hanson, did you have...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Anyone who can answer this, and perhaps that's the wrong way to set it up because everyone will answer, or no one will. Is it practical to, in this particular instance, to limit Mr. Coit to the confidential information and no one else so that he cannot share it with anyone else?
This is Kara from staff. My concern with that would just be that in reading the rule, the rule's available to everybody, and I don't know how, if the commission, it seems like a real slippery slope to start allowing particular people access to confidential information, but not others. So, you know, in this particular case, what if five John Q. publics out there read the commission's website and want to get involved? Well, I think it seems like a slippery slope to allow some people confidential information and others none.
Thank you. Ms. Wiest?
Yes, this is Rolaine Wiest. I just had a question first, and my question is, did the parties anticipate that Mr. Coit would make written comments at the time of the briefs, or would it be before the briefs, or what are the timing considerations here?
Well, from my perspective, I would think that we'd want to be able to make written comments after the hearing, you know, after we've sat and listened to everything and had a chance to review all of the evidence. I wouldn't want to have to make written comments going into the hearing without, you know. So, I'm thinking participation in the briefing process, basically.
You're saying making comments during the briefing?
Yeah.
At the same time as the briefing?
Yeah.
Was
that my thought?
Was that your thought, Mr. Weishart?
Hey, it had been my assumption it would be tied into the briefing some way. Depending on how the commission wants briefs, if it's a brief where Sprint goes and then the ILEC and Mr. Coit goes and then Sprint has a reply, that would seem to make sense to me.
And then there's also in the comments talk about oral presentations. And when you're talking about oral presentations, are all the parties in agreement that you're talking about orally arguing this possibly after the briefs are done? Is that what the oral presentations are in reference to?
That would be my understanding.
And Ms. Weiss, this is Talbot Weishart. That's how I read his. That's how I interpreted the comments. I had made the assumption it would be an oral argument along with everybody else.
Okay, thank you. And then I guess at this point, if I could just, I'll just make a recommendation if the commission wants to consider it. But
Ms. Weiss, this is James Prakash. Can I just add one thing before you do that?
Go ahead.
On the existing procedural schedule that's there, I think that the time frames are such in terms of the tightness of them. If someone was going to offer writing, I would think would need to be done within those same parameters that Mr. Weishart and I are going to brief the issues, because I don't know if there's additional time to allow someone to submit some writing that Mr. Weishart or I would have to respond to.
Yeah.
I have a different thought than that, but the times are pretty tight already.
Right. Actually, my thought was whether the written comments should be prior to the brief. But I think it's established that it would be consistent with the timing of the briefs. Anyway, I would recommend that the commission grant clarification in this process. And the clarification has to do with that Rule 15.06. I don't necessarily agree that a party has to write out beforehand their contentions in the case. I think the way that rule was written is that really the rule was written probably to allow somebody to show up at the hearing and give their comments. And to the extent that the contentions are not reasonably pertinent to the issues presented, I believe at that point somebody could object. I would disagree with SDTA that they should be allowed access to the confidential material. And again, this is based on the fact that it's under the 15.06. And I think Ms. Van Bakken did a very nice job of explaining why this is a slippery slope. And also, I think if the commission goes down this path and allows a person who appears under 15.6 to get to say, okay, there's a protective order in place in the docket, so all we have to do is sign that protective order and we also can have access to that information, I really think it's going to deter future parties to dockets from mutually agreeing to these types of protective orders and entering into them, because at that point they don't know who else is going to be able to jump into that protective order and say, oh, now we have access to that confidential information. So I think there really are limits on a person's participation in 15.06. And one of the other issues, and maybe I don't have them all, but the last issue I would reference is, you know, the limitation on the comments. And I guess I would just, you know, distinguish them this way. I mean, to the extent that a party wants to make comments and reference FCC decisions, I mean, obviously I think they can reference any FCC decisions. To the extent they're referencing written comments or testimony from other cases, then I think that is a problem, because I think you are putting or attempting to put in evidence that is not subject to cross-examination. And I guess that would just be a general warning as to anyone who would be filing comments, that they really need to be limited to the scope of what has been brought forth in this docket.
Might make another, you know, comment, and then this was Rick. I'd ask for any response you might have. You know, it seems to me if you have three buckets, you know, that stuff which is clearly not confidential, the second bucket is stuff that's clearly confidential, and the third bucket, which is stuff that is sort of a gray area. And it seems to me in the past that the commission hasn't had any problem providing deference and the benefit of the doubt to, you know, groups that wanted to keep information confidential, because we have in the past had a pretty liberal intervention policy. I wonder if in a proceeding like this, it seems to me that the commission would grant far less benefit of the doubt as to how much would go in that. You know, if it's a close call, I could see the commission deciding that maybe that should not be not confidential, since there might be so many interested persons who are not parties to the proceeding. Mr. Resort, any thoughts you'd have?
Mr. Chairman, I don't feel that Sprint has been very overreaching with confidential information. Quite a bit of the discovery we provided, we never claimed was confidential.
Sorry to interrupt, Mr. Zwerken, and I should make it clear, I'm not talking specifically about this docket, but just sort of the general standard operating procedure of the commission, at least in a couple of years since I've been here.
I think the commission certainly, and has the inherent right, if there's a piece of evidence marked confidential, and a commissioner has a question as to why it would be confidential, and the party can't provide a reasonable basis, that the commission would say, we're not going to treat it as confidential, or we're going to give it not the same control as this type of document, or we might allow a broader review of it. I think the commission probably has some of that authority of the record, because if you look at the commission's rules, the commission's rules actually have a procedure where a party, if I file something confidential, can request the commission to review that filing and how it was designated confidential. And so under your existing rules, I think those would apply even in potentially in a situation where a hearing is, they could make a claim that that type of information shouldn't be confidential, or there should be some limited access to it. I hope that responds to your question.
Yeah, thanks very much, Mr. Resort. Any other commissioner or advisor comments or questions? I don't know that it wouldn't be my intention to put it in a motion, but I would just at this point echo my agreement with Ms. Weiss on her third issue as to what would be appropriate to have in the comments from parties that are allowed to appear. And I do think she's got it about right. There are a number of things that would make sense, a number of outside things that were not entered into the record that would make sense to have in that briefing, and there would probably be things that would be inappropriate. Motion isn't appropriate at this time, but that is the way at least one commissioner, I think, would see that as well.
I appreciate your comments, because I think all of the presentations by all of the parties have been somewhat compelling, and I've appreciated, with the exception of Mr. Coit's presentation when he says this is the way they do it in Minnesota. Ordinarily, that's a that takes care of it for me right away.
Well, I really would like to thank you all for taking the time on this because it is important to us, and I appreciate the time, and it's probably gone on a little bit longer than it should have, so I appreciate it.
Thank you for letting me put that little bit of levity in this most serious issue. I was, frankly, you probably noticed I hesitated when we were taking the vote a couple months ago because I just about voted for intervention at that time. Perhaps that's why you're pursuing it, because you saw some reluctance on my part. I don't know. Forgive me, everyone else, if that's the if that's the reason. I'd also like to thank Kara and, excuse me, Ms. Van Bakker. Is it Mrs. now, can we say? What?
Mrs. Aronson.
You're making it difficult for us. Formerly Ms. Van Bakker and Ms. Wiest for the information. I lean very much towards the information that they have provided, and I think the clarification by Ms. Wiest, 99% I am comfortable with, and I just need to have a little bit more research on my own part, I suspect, in order to come to a complete conclusion on that. So that's if you're looking for where people are about to fall, that's where I would be falling.
And with the additional research you're talking about, wanting to, what would, if a party was allowed to appear, what they would be able to have in their brief, what would be allowable, what would not?
Precisely.
Okay, thanks.
I really lean, when we're in a situation of intervention, I generally lean towards, if there's any doubt at all, I lean towards intervention. And this, being constrained by the law and trying to ascertain just exactly what's the best thing to do here, I think our counsel has provided us the correct pathway. And at the same time, I just want to make sure that there's every opportunity for all parties to be heard properly and completely, and that's where I'm just having a little bit of a challenge.
You know, if I could add one thing there, and I've thought about this for some time, it seems to me that the rules probably do need to be looked at with respect to the procedure in arbitrations. You know, we've been granted intervention in some past arbitrations. And, you know, I understand how the commission got to the position that it's come to, but at the same time, you know, the issues that pop up in those proceedings are pretty important issues. Obviously, it's been something that's been addressed by other states in terms of how they're going to take care of due process issues. And, I think there are due process concerns anytime, you know, the property interests of various parties are potentially affected. And I guess I would encourage the commission to maybe look at some of those rules and rather than go through this again 2 or 3 years from now, mm-hmm. maybe try to be a little more specific in terms of what your rules permit in arbitration proceedings in particular, because they are in some other states. And I think, you know, you've got some resources, maybe not Minnesota, but some other ones.
If any interested individual out there has some proposed rules for the commission to consider a rulemaking docket, they can certainly drop those off to Relaine Wiest. She'd be happy to review them. I, in the interest of time, I do think there we've had a good discussion of the issues. I think I would, I don't know if a formal motion is necessary, but I'll go ahead and make one, that we do rule that SDTA has met the threshold to be a party allowed to appear. I would further move that the commission deny their request to have access to confidential information. I would further, you know, formally instruct staff to review all information that is filed with the parties as confidential, and take a good look to ensure that that is indeed confidential, and that if they decide that perhaps it's a questionable call, that they would bring that before the commissioners so that we might make a ruling to make sure that as much information as possible that deserves to be in the public's eye can be so. That's the motion.
I'd like to say that I feel that the commission's decisions will affect the future, and I think they do affect the industry. I do not feel that SBTA is John Q. Public. That's why I struggle with this. But without opening another can of worms and possibly diluting the the sanctity and the importance of confidential information. I'll second the motion.
I will concur with the motion.
Motion carries. Thanks very much to everyone who appeared. We'll proceed now to telecom item number 10, I believe. That is TC06-195. It's in the matter of the application of ITI Inmate Telephone Incorporated for COA to provide inter-exchange telecommunication services in South Dakota. The question is, today shall the Commission grant a certificate of authority to ITI Inmate Telephone Incorporated? At this time, we'll look to Ms. Kramer and Mr. Solem.
Mr. Chairman, this is Nathan Solem. ITI is seeking a certificate of authority to offer interchange services, including alternate operator services. Specifically, ITI will offer automated calling services to inmates of correctional facilities within the state of South Dakota. The applicant has agreed to restrictions from accepting customer deposits or advance payments and also from offering any prepaid services. The applicant has requested waivers of the following alternate operator service rules to facilitate service at correctional facilities. Those rules, the first one is 2010-2405-4, which requires posting at the pay telephones, (6), which prohibits call blocking, (7), which requires the provision of 911 services, (8), which requires transfers to other carriers, and (11), which requires the applicant's address and phone number on the bill. In this case, they're going to use a third-party biller, and the third-party billing agency's address and phone will be on the bill. The applicant has met the requirements for the granting of a certificate of authority. Therefore, staff recommends the Commission grant the waiver requests and issue ITI Inmate Telephone Incorporated an inter-exchange certificate of authority, subject to restrictions from offering any prepaid services and from collecting customer deposits or advance payments without the prior approval of the Commission.
Thank you very much, Mr. Solem. Any questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, I move that the Commission grant the COA to ITI Inmate Telephone with the waivers recommended by staff, subject to the restrictions recommended by staff.
I will second.
I concur.
Motion carries. Telecom number 11 is TC06-203. It's in the matter of the application of New Horizons Communications Corporation for a COA to provide inter-exchange telecommunication services in South Dakota. The question is, shall the Commission grant the COA to New Horizons Communications? Mr. Sanger, Ms. Van Bakker.
Thank you. This is a standard application for inter-exchange authority, so I'll be brief. The applicant has requested a waiver from filing a cash flow statement as required by ARSD 2010-2402-8. Subsequently, they have agreed to the restrictions from accepting any customer deposits and advance payments or from offering any prepaid services, including prepaid calling cards. With that, I would recommend the Commission grant the waivers and issue New Horizons a certificate of authority subject to the restrictions.
Thank you, Mr. Singer. Any comments or questions by commissioners or advisors? If not, a motion is in order.
A motion in the matter of TC06-203 that the Commission grant certificate of authority to the New Horizons Communications Corp.
Second.
And we always do this, but I want to make sure that it's clear for the record that that would be subject to the restrictions proposed by staff. And a second, and I'll concur. Motion carries. Item number 12 is in the matter of the approval of agreements and dockets TC07-001, TC07-002, as well as TC07-004. And I believe those all deal with agreements with Quest. That's not right. Well, the first one deals with filing for approval of terms and conditions for interconnection and unbundled network elements, ancillary services, and resale of telecommunication services between Quest and Capital Telephone Company. 002 deals with approval of an adoption agreement between Quest and American Fiber Network. And 005 deals with approval of an interconnection agreement between Venture Communication Technology, LLC, and Jefferson Telephone Company. The question for the Commission today is, shall the Commission approve the agreements listed above? Ms. Van Bakker.
Thank you. This is Kara Van Bakker from staff. The agreements were all properly filed and executed. They do not appear to contain any discriminatory language. No comments were filed, and staff never recommends approval.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments by commissioners or advisors?
Move for approval of TC07-001, 002, and 005 according to staff's recommendations.
Second.
I concur.
I believe that concludes the business before the commission today. Our next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be March 13th, and a variety of other announcements on the agenda for those people that are concerned. Thanks much. Have a great afternoon.